Thank you very much. I'm going to try not to mention the word Tehran until maybe if you ask some questions in the last 5 minutes, yeah? Because as Jay said, this was really fixed some time ago. Just to give you two pieces of background, first of all, how does the head of chat come to be talk about the Tariqata? And the answer is that this was my academic research way back in a small university called Oxford in the 1970s. But I've followed the history of the Nasrani culture and of the movements within the Haredi community ever since, number one. Number two is that, for those of you who were not here last week I spoke about the Chasam Sofer. And the way in which the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moses Sofer, who lived from 1762 until 1839, faced a huge number of issues to do with how to deal with emancipation and the open society. And I don't want to go back over it because we obviously spoke about it at length last week, but basically, with emancipation in the beginning of the late 18th, beginning of the 19th century, Jews in Europe, particularly Jews in Western Europe, Jews in Central Europe, not so much in Russia and Eastern Europe, but Jews in Central Europe and Western Europe, faced a completely new situation. I'm not going to go back over it because that's what we spoke about last week. But basically, Jews began to be free individual citizens in an open society. And for this reason, Judaism being Jewish, began to be, as it were, a voluntary activity, just as it is today. The Canadian government does not concern itself with whether anyone around this table keeps Shabbos or doesn't keep Shabbos, right? Because in the open society, religion is a voluntary commitment of the individual citizen, right? And that is the basic problem with which the Chasam Sofer grappled. With that came a number of brand new challenges to the traditional way of life of rabbinic Judaism as it has existed certainly throughout the Middle Ages. And these involve really, you can bring this down to three things. And I'm boiling down a very complex thing into three headings. But I'm talking about these three headings because they are a theme that will follow us from Hungary in the early 19th century right to Tehran. Yeah, these are, number one, authority. Yeah, which group, who has authority in Jewish life? Who holds authority in Jewish life? Until emancipation, it was clear that authority, certainly in Europe, was held by was held to rabbinic law. After emancipation, and we discussed this at length last week, in Hungary, in Germany, in France, etc., authority in Jewish communities passed to whoever was elected the leader of your Gemeinde, the leader of your Kehillah. And in some cases it was rabbis, in some cases it was lay people. In some cases it was lay people who were already open to the number two problem, which was the question of education and the free exchange of ideas. In the early 19th century, partly because Jews desired social mobility and educational mobility, the Jewish educational system changed radically. And under the influence of the early Maskilim, particularly Vesely, the circle around Mendelssohn, etc., the pattern of Jewish education started to change. It no longer was wholly traditional, but Jewish schools, the first Jewish Freischule, founded in 1796, and it for the first time introduced the teaching of secular subjects into the Jewish school system, something that in our day we more or less take for granted, right? What is this building other than a building where Jewish studies, or where Limudei Kodesh and secular studies are taught together, right? But in those days, that was revolutionary. So you had, number one, authority. Who holds the authority in Jewish life? Number two, you had education. What ideas and what cultures are permissible within the Jewish ambit, right? Within the Jewish community. And allied to both of those, of course, is the question of leadership. And I mentioned that the brilliance of the Chassam Sofer, of Rabbi Moses Sofer, who lived in Bratislava in what is now Czechoslovakia, but was basically Hungarian. The brilliance of Rabbi Moses Sofer was that he looked at the open society around him. He looked at the reform movements, at the assimilation, at all sorts of synthesizing movements, and he realized that one of the freedoms of the open society is the freedom not to take part in it. Yeah? One of the paradoxical freedoms of the open society is the freedom to withdraw from it. And the Chassam Sofer understood and propagated the idea that cultural self-isolation was the survival strategy for traditional rabbinic Judaism in the open society. And that is an hour and a half session last week, which in itself was a contraction from about 5 hours to an hour and a half, and that is an hour and a half into 2 minutes. So you're the Dibakar. But I did mention that one of the things that the Chassam Sofer encouraged was the early settlement of what was then Palestine, right? I'm using that obviously in a totally non-political way, but that's what it was called at the time, right? He encouraged his settlers to go and begin or join what was called the Old Yeshuv in Palestine. From the late 18th century, there had already been some movement of Jews from Europe to begin settling in Eretz Yisrael. Most of them were actually famously followers of the Vilna Gaon, but there were also some Hasidim, and when the Chassam Sofer started his push to encourage his settlers to resettle Eretz Yisrael, of course they were joined by Hungarians, and I will come on to that in a moment. It should be said that of course the dominant group in the Old Yeshuv was of course the Sephardim. But the absolutely crucial thing to understand for today, is that many of these groups, particularly the Talmidim of the Chassam Sofer, particularly the followers of the Chassam Sofer, were interested in resettling Eretz Yisrael, not only because they saw that as a great duty, and the 19th century developments of steamships and railways and telegraphs and money transfers and posts and all of these things greatly facilitated that, right? It made possible fairly easily what had not been possible years before, right? But they went to Israel, or to Palestine. Please, I'm going to use the word Palestine because that's what it was, so please don't, there's no political whatever to that. They went to Palestine because they saw it as a sanctuary against the encroachments of the Enlightenment and the encroachments of modernity that were so troubling them and by which they felt so threatened in Europe. Palestine at that time was ruled by the Ottomans, other than a brief period, 1837 to 1840, but it was ruled by the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire, as is known, was a pre-modern construction. The Ottomans had no interest whatsoever in reform, in modernity, in enlightenment, etc., 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 and therefore they kept very strong control over their provinces. And the Jews who lived in Palestine felt that they were there, right? Immune virtually. To all of the things that were troubling them in Europe, whether they were philosophical, whether they were linguistic. You may remember that the Chassam Sofer made a great campaign against the learning of foreign languages. Why? Because the learning of foreign languages, of German in particular, was a cultural gateway. If you knew German, you had access to many of the dangerous ideas floating around. Yeah? So that is basically where they went. But today we will see that immunity, right? That Palestine is the old Yeshiva's sanctuary, became totally permeable. It was not an ironclad wall by any means. There is no one can, you know, seal themselves off hermetically from the society that surrounds them. And by the end of the 19th century, in fact, by the third quarter of the 19th century, the very same problems that were problematic to the Jewish communities in Europe began to appear in Palestine. And the origins of Notori Carta does not come into being, some people argue, 1939, 1945 appears to be the first time that the name was actually used. But Notori Carta comes into being as a continuation of the struggle of the Chasam Sofer, right? To number one, culturally self-isolate his community, to allow them to survive as a voluntarily closed community. Number two, even more important, and perhaps more as a continuation of the Chasam Sofer's struggle to fight against the assumption of leadership in Jewish communities by non-Orthodox and non-rabbinic figures. Yeah, the question of authority here is crucial. Now, all of you, I'm surprised no one has yet put up their hand and said, the Messiah, that we will deal with that. Probably we will get to it around about 10:30, right? So please hold all the questions about the Messiah and holding the land, etc., for some time. I mentioned that the inhabitants of the Old Yeshuv, by the way, the term Old Yeshuv is used to describe the pre-Zionist or the non-Zionist Jews who lived in the Holy Land, in the Land of Israel. Not many people say, you know, the Old Yeshuv is the Jews who lived there for hundreds of years. No area has more nonsense written about it than this whole question, right? Number one, other than a very small community of Sephardim, there were virtually no Ashkenazi Jews in Palestine until around about the early 1800s. There were a few, right? There were a few, but they were very, very small and very insignificant in influence. So the idea that Ashkenazi Jews had lived in Palestine for thousands of years in peace is total baloney, number one. Number two, those of you who've been at my lectures at the Beit at any point in the last 9 years, or even here last week, know that I have a certain frustration around what I call art scroll history. Right? The art scroll history of the Old Yeshuv is of twinkly-eyed, pious, gentle people, right, who lived at peace among themselves in a perfect harmonious community, which was totally permeated with Kedusha and Ruchnius and wonderful things, and only the arrival of the Zionist settlers at the end of the 19th century disturbed that. That is also, regrettably, not quite true. The Old Yeshuv, during the 19th century, was riven with machloikas, was riven with violence. They argued among themselves, between themselves, with everyone else. There's a wonderful scholar in Israel called Morgenstern, who over the last few years has published fabulous research on, among other things, the messianic expectations around the year 1840. Yeah, 1840 was the year 5600 in the Hebrew calendar, and he has shown very conclusively that there were huge messianic expectations among the Jewish community in Yerushalayim around that year. And he's also shown that when the Messiah didn't come, at least two leading members of the Perushim, of the Misnagdic Yishuv in Jerusalem, converted to Christianity, yeah, as a result. So, you know, it wasn't all plain sailing and it wasn't all sort of twinkly-eyed, you know, old men, etc., 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 etc. And the other, we could talk for an hour and a half about the myths about the old Yishuv. It was also not true that people went there to die. Yeah, some people went to Yerushalayim, no, definitely at the end of their lives, but there was an economy and there were young people and there was a society and there was a chevra. So it is a little more complicated of what we were talking about. So who were the Jewish inhabitants? Yes.
You've made it very clear that there weren't Ashkenazim there for hundreds of years.
Correct.
But Sephardim?
Yes, there was
Sephardim. Was there a strong Sephardim?
The people who lived in Eretz Yisrael before they were swamped completely by the first and particularly the second Aliyah were the following categories. Number one, Sephardim, right? Sephardim lived mainly in Jerusalem, yeah, in Jerusalem, in the Old City. Smallish numbers, but they were a continuous presence. They were mainly merchants who were connected to Jewish families in Damascus and in Egypt. And there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, a lot of trade between all of those places. Number one were the Sephardim, who were in general merchants. Number two were the group that I mentioned, the pupils of the Vilna Gaon, who are known generally as Purushim. Yeah, for whatever reason, there's a lot of debate about why they were called that, but they were known as Purushim, and they started in the very end of the 18th century, and in the beginning of the 19th century, their numbers increased. They were the dominant group of Ashkenazim. Number three,
also in Jerusalem,
but particularly also in Tzfat, in Hebron and in Tiberia. In Tiberia were mainly the third group, who were the very small number of Hasidim. There were a small Hasidish Aliyah in the 19th century, mainly in Tiberia, and also in Hebron. Right, so you had Yerushalayim, Hebron, Tiberia, and Tzfat were the main four centers. There's also an intriguing group about which very little is known. Yitzhak ben Tzvi, the former president of Israel, in the 1920s, went on horseback around Israel, finding the remnants of the Jewish felachim, the Jewish peasants who had been there since the year, who had never left Israel. The most famous of these groups lived in families lived in a village called Peki Inn in the Galil. But there are very, very, he wrote a whole, his book is called She'erit HaPleita, and he talks about his travels on horseback through the length and breadth of Palestine, of finding villages where, for example, in the south side of Har Hebron, there are a number of villages where the local Muslims regard these people as Jews. Yeah, they're totally socially isolated. They are meant to be descendants of Jews. They have certain, you go on the Minhagim chase, which is can be very seductive but very misleading. Yeah. So there were a tiny number of Jews who'd lived, of peasants who were indistinguishable from the local Arabs and Bedouin. How were they organized? How were the Ashkenazim organized? The Ashkenazim were organized, and I'm explaining this because it figures in our story. The Ashkenazim were organized on the kolel system. Nothing to do with the kololim that we know today, right? Take that out of your mind. Kolel system was that if you arrived in Yerushalayim, or to a lesser degree any of the other three cities, if you arrived in Yerushalayim, you registered at the kolel of the area that you came from. So there was a kolel Holland, there was a kolel Volhynia, there was a kolel Podolia, there was a kolel etc., etc., etc. And if you walk down Mea Shearim today, you can still see some of these institutions still exist, because they're housing associations, there are all sorts of things. But each of these kololim had the right to receive donations from their designated geographical area, right? So if you were kolel Volhynia, which is an area just north of Poland, you had the right to send messengers, mashulachim, to that area, or to receive any income coming from there. This was distributed to the families who were registered as members of that kolel by a system known as the chalukah, the distribution, right? Everyone got a little sort of stipend, and that's how many people lived. You will immediately understand that some of these kololim were very rich and some of them were very poor, right? And that, as I said, that figures in our story. But as early as the 1840s, little cracks in the in the pre-modern structure, the pre-modern atmosphere of Yerushalayim started to appear. As early as 1844, Moses Montefiore, who remember was English and therefore was probably very unaware of many of the arguments going on in Hungary and elsewhere, suggested establishing a vocational school for the sons of the yeshuv to improve productivity. Montefiore was very interested in making the yeshuv, particularly in the Jerusalem area, economically productive, hence his windmill and all sorts of other things. And Montefiore was a remarkable person who made, if memory serves me correctly, nine visits in all to the Holy Land. Major undertaking at that time. And he put a lot of money into the economic productivity of the yeshuv. He was very worried that people with his sort of Victorian sense of noblesse oblige, he was very worried that the people in the yeshuv were starving, and he encouraged a lot of trades and vocations. Printing was one, all sorts of trades, the windmill and the idea of grinding flour, etc., 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 was another. But he suggested as early as 1844 establishing a vocational school for the sons of the yeshuv who simply were not suited to studying all of their lives. He was quickly rebuffed, and in 1849 he revived the idea, and from this one of the Rav Yeshaya Brodkey, who was one of the leaders of the Lithuanian of the Talmidei Hagro in Yerushalayim, wrote a very interesting response to Montefiore, which he published. And there he was absolutely explicit. He said, "We came here to escape all of this. We came here to escape reform of our schools. We came here to escape the teaching." One of Montefiore's suggestions, figures later, was that the kids should be taught Arabic, because Arabic was the commercial language of that whole area. The Sephardi kids all knew Arabic, but the Ashkenazi kids didn't, right? So therefore, it was very difficult for them to trade or to go to a market or whatever. So Montefiore wanted to learn Arabic. And Brodkey sends him a very clear letter. We still have the text of it, which says, "We came here to escape all of this. Please don't start trying to tell us how to run our schools. Please don't start telling us that we have to modernize our curriculum. Please don't start telling us that we have to teach our kids foreign languages." He says it absolutely in these words. "We came here to escape this phenomenon."
He was describing himself, I believe,
he was a Spanish and Portuguese of the Anglo-Jewish Sephardic aristocracy. He was about as you wouldn't see him as a Sephardi, right? He was Sephardi by genealogy, but he wasn't Sephardi in the sense that the Sephardim in Yerushalayim are Sephardim, right? Oh, I was hoping to save that to spring it on you as a surprise. The language of the Ashkenazim was Hebrew until the Zionists came and started speaking Ivrit, to which point we have a clear diary entry from Ben Sion Yabla, the Maggid of Yerushalayim, who says the first time that someone in 1906, that somebody walked down the streets of Yerushalayim on a Shabbat afternoon selling lemonade, sarsaparilla, those of you of a certain age will recognize that term, right? Selling lemonade in Ivrit, chatzi grush lebakbuk, says then we understood that Ivrit became not only a secular, but a secularizing language, and we switched back to Yiddish. Time they spoke Hebrew, right? Okay, right. Ben Yehuda did not revive the Hebrew language. Ben Yehuda formalized, dictionaryized, worked out the grammar, etc. But Hebrew was a spoken language throughout the old yeshuv of Yerushalayim throughout the 19th century. Yeah, Ben Yehuda wrote the dictionary, he wrote the grammar, he coined a number of modern words, but it was a spoken language throughout the 19th century. Yeah.
Was that the spark? What was their religious work? Was it a traditional society?
come, at that point, yes, but we'll come on to that. Yeah, we'll get to the role of the Sephardim. This is a complicated story. I'm trying to make it simple, and I'm trying to finish my
midday. I was under the impression that Ben Yehuda actually, after this turn, when nobody's speaking, it's sort of against the rules to speak it, he and Hershenson, in their household, started again speaking Hebrew, and that was...
Well, they started speaking a different sort of Hebrew, right? I mean, Hershenson himself got into a lot of trouble, and that's why he had to come to America, because they were over Hebrew. Anyway, but I can't... Guys, you want to be out of here by 11? I can't deal with every detail. But by 1856, it was already too late. In 1856, remember the Jews who lived in Yerushalayim were mainly still citizens of the countries from which they came. They couldn't take Ottoman citizenship. So therefore, the consul generals of the different countries, all of whom had representatives in Jerusalem because of the Christian importance of Jerusalem, Patnish, you know, was you had to have a consul in Jerusalem. The consuls wielded a great deal of influence as both protectors and promoters of their citizens in Yerushalayim. Now, if you go into the old city even now, into Jaffa Gate, just look on your right, opposite Migdal David, there's still the Austrian consulate post office, right? There's still a sign up there. I think it's still there, saying the Austrian post office. Every European power, as a matter of prestige, had a consul in Jerusalem. So the British consul James Finn, who wrote one of the most important memoirs of Yerushalayim called Stirring Times, and was very, very thick with the Perushim, was a very important person. Later on, the American consul becomes very important, but at this point, the Austrian consul promoted a gentleman called Ludwig Augustus Frankl. Ludwig Augustus Frankl was a maskil who had started several modern Jewish schools in Vienna. And he arrived in Jerusalem in 1856, or a year or so before. He published a book called Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, which was an educational manifesto for the reform and the making the schools in Jerusalem productive. He came with funds from the Lemel, what was called the Lemel Foundation in Jerusalem. It was, I think, named after a family called Lemel. But he came just as the Alliance Francaise was setting up, schools in Middle Eastern Jewish communities. He came to do the same thing in Jerusalem on behalf of the Lemel family. He built his school under the protection of the Austrian consul. The school still stands. It is in Jerusalem. Again, I'm sorry to keep on appealing to those of you of a certain age, but if you remember where the old Edison Cinema used to be, right? Okay, so right opposite the Edison Cinema, there's a large wall, but if you're on a bus and you can see over the wall, there's a very nice stone building, and you can still see the coat of arms of the Lemel family there. That was the original Lemel school. It is now a Sadigor Rishin Talmud Torah, which is interesting. But he managed to establish his school, and this was really the first modern institution in Yerushalayim. Interesting. The same Rabbi Shaya Brodsky wrote all change, because actually the Lemel school, when it was established, was not revolutionary. It wasn't reform. It just had secular studies. It was not a reform. There's nothing non-orthodox about it. Brodsky wrote, all change leads to reform and secularization. All change, right? Chasam Sofer Kol Kodosh Asa Min HaTorah. Interestingly, some of the Sephardim in Jerusalem supported the Lemel school, because the Sephardim were merchants, and they understood that their sons and daughters were leaving Jerusalem as soon as they got to adulthood, because they could not make a living there. And the Sephardim very much wanted to encourage trade and industry. And they saw that if they had to send their kids out of Jerusalem to be educated, they would never come back. So the Sephardim supported, and some of the Ashkenazim supported the Lemel school. But by the 1870s, the pressures for change were really building. And you had at this point, again, a development of the groups within the yeshuv and of the rabbinic authority. First of all, you have the emergence of a moderate religious extreme, almost Haskalah. And these are people like Yechiel Michael Pinnes, Rivlin family, the Frumkin family, all of whom were Ashkenazim, most of whom were already second generation Perushim, second in some cases third generation Perushim, but they were more open, right, more open to development and more open to realistic change. But you then had the question of who was the Rav of Jerusalem, the question of rabbinic authority. In the 1870s, late 1870s, is when this really begins to heat up. Reb Shmuel Salant, first of all, there was no such thing as the chief rabbi, as an Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Jerusalem. There was a Sephardi Chacham Bashi, who was appointed by the Ottomans. There's no such thing as a Sephardi chief rabbi of Jerusalem, because no one could agree. If you think about it for a moment, if the struggle was between the different kolalim, right, they would never agree on appointing a chief rabbi, because the strong ones would never agree to a chief rabbi who was associated with one of the weaker kolalim, and the weaker kolalim would never agree to one chief rabbi who was associated with one of the stronger kolalim, because it would mean takeover. So there was no chief rabbi. However, and this is important because this is the whole Rav Kook story, in Jerusalem there were two major institutions. One of them was the Yeshiva Eitz Chaim, right? Yeshiva Eitz Chaim is on Jaffa Road, it's still there, near Machane Yehuda, it's hidden behind shops, but it's still there, big tall building. Yeshiva Eitz Chaim had been founded in the 1860s by a group of Hungarians, and the Bikur Cholim Hospital. The Bikur Cholim Hospital, which today is the Bikur Cholim Hospital, is a very old Jerusalem institution, and both of these institutions appointed a joint, what we would call rabbinical authority. He was known as Rav De'ach V'Bach, Rav De Eitz Chaim V'Bikur Cholim, right? Rav Ach, and the Rav De'ach V'Bach was regarded as the overall rabbinic authority in Yerushalayim. If you go to the Toronto Museum, to the ROM, they have that little Jewish corner, right? And the last time I was there, which was admittedly 3 or 4 years ago, they had a little, some sort of, I think, collecting tin that had the name of Rav De'ach V'Bach on it. It was quite interesting. It was wrongly labeled, as I recall. Anyway, but the Rav of De'ach V'Bach was the famous Reb Shmuel Salant. Reb Shmuel Salant, who lived till 101, was the Rav of Yerushalayim longer than Queen Victoria was the Queen of England. He was the Rav of Yerushalayim from 1841 until 1910, 69 years. He died in his aged 101. And Shmuel Salant was a Lithuanian. He was from the Talmidei HaGra. And he was quite a gentle soul, right? He was a profound. His writings, his tshuvas have all been published. And he was a... You know, he was a wise, I think a wise and, non-aggressive leader, widely respected. But in 1877, a gentleman by the name of Moshe Yehoshua Leib Diskin arrived in Jerusalem. Diskin was the Rav of Brisk. He was not a Brisker in the Soloveitchik sense, but he came from the town of Brisk where he had been the rabbi. And Diskin was a dyed-in-the-wool follower of the Chasam Sofer, a dyed-in-the-wool disciple of the Chasam Sofer. And he immediately started, you know, you have to understand, as I said, that many of the centers of power and influence in the old Yishuv were institutions, because institutions attracted donations from abroad. Diskin started a number of institutions as soon as he arrived. He started a yeshiva called Oho Moshe, which became the center of the Hungarian kolel in Yerushalayim. He started the famous Diskin Orphanage, which still exists, and he immediately was appointed the head of the Hungarian kolel, the head of the Hungarian kolel. Diskin was, and I use this as an honorific title, a kanoi in the Yerushalayim sense. He was a fanatic. He was a the word fanatic, kanoi in Hebrew, is a badge of honor in certain circles, particularly in Yerushalayim, and Diskin was a Gevaltiger Kanoi. Even more than he himself was his second wife, Sonia. the famous Brisker Robertson. There is a famous, it was actually up, a copy of this was up for auction on a site called Virtual Judaica about a year ago. And it was, I really wanted to buy it, it was far too expensive in the end. There was a famous poster which was circulated in Yerushalayim in the about 1880, 1881, which was headed in Yiddish. It says, "A chutzpah from the Brisker Robertson," right? His wife ran the show. His wife ran Yerushalayim, right? His, if you, David Yellin and others wrote pages about this woman who must have been, if I want to put it delicately, a very powerful personality. And the arrival of the Diskins changed the thing entirely. He decided to stop all, to go out to war against the encroachment of every inch of modernity and change in the old Yishuv. So the first battle was in 1878, a year after he arrived, over the teaching of modern languages. Montefiore again, actually, wanted again to teach, to give money to teach Arabic to the poorer students, i.e. the less academically able students at Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Jerusalem. And it was going to be outside the yeshiva hours and not on the premises and somewhere else. And you know, this was regarded as a major sort of test case of power. And Moshe Yoshua Leib Diskin, the Brisker Rav, put out a cherem which was bigger than anything ever seen in Jerusalem before. He forbade, A, the teaching of any foreign language, number one. Number two, he forbade people to take private tutors to teach a foreign language. Yeah, he forbade people to hold books in foreign languages. Yeah, it was a very, very far-reaching cherem that really just said, we will not allow any foreign language anywhere in here. And Shmuel Salant said the famous thing. I think I even mentioned it last week in the discussion when the students of the Brisker Rav came to him and said, "Ah, Shmuel Salant, how can you allow foreign languages?" He said, "Jerusalem is not Berlin, and Arabic is not German." Yeah? Jerusalem is not Berlin and Arabic is not German. Meaning that learning Arabic was not a gateway into anything dangerous, right? It was not, there was no, at that time, if there was the beginnings of an Arabic enlightenment, it certainly hadn't reached those circles. By this point, it was a losing battle. Yeah. Anyone who had listened to him. Right. Certainly the members of the Hungarian Kollel. Right. Certainly many of the other people in the Kollel. But the Yeshiva at this time was split between the moderates, i.e., the followers of Salant, and the extremists, who were the followers of Diskin and the Hungarians. But by 1880. There were already over 300 students attending modern schools in Jerusalem. There were about 540 male students attending traditional yeshivas in Jerusalem. Then a number of things happened. First of all, remember, we're talking about the end of the 19th century. By 1896, a number of different things were happening. Number one, the center of Jewish life, and certainly the center of Jewish funding, had shifted from Eastern Europe to America, right? To America. What was going to happen to the money? And there were already mishulachim going all around America. We have their diaries, we have their documents. And of course, you know, it was much better to get a dollar from a Jew who is trying to keep a store in Wisconsin or Montana or somewhere than a ruble from somebody in Russia, because the dollar was worth much more. Well, all of you have seen, if you've been to Yerushalayim, the signs about Kupat Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes, right? The Tzedakah of Rabbi Meir Bal Hanes is still the catch-all phrase for money coming into the traditional community that has no home. In other words, money coming from Holland, money coming from Poland, money coming from Minsk, money coming from Romania, right? all had their kollel in Yerushalayim. Any money that came from there went to the Romanian, from Romania went to the Romanian kollel. Money that came from anywhere else, the shadarim, the mishulachim, who went to the Far East, and Australia, all sorts of places, went into a big pot called Kupat Rabbi Meir Bar Hanes. The funding money from America was a bigger and bigger and bigger proportion of this. Rabbi Moshe Yehoshua Leib Diskin did something very smart in 1896. He said, we are going to be the Kollel America, right? The Kollel America, i.e., any money coming from America, guys, this is where it comes to. And this caused a huge, huge, huge row. There was an overall community, Vad Klali LeYudei Yerushalayim, that broke apart over this. By this time, Rabbi Salant was very, very old, well into his 90s. He was very weak and he couldn't affect it. The second thing, of course, that happened was that by this time, the second Aliyah was beginning to arrive in Palestine. Yes, he was. If you go down Meir Shearim now, on the how can I describe this? Just at the point where the road sort of narrows. Yeah, as you're coming from Geula, you go down Meir Shearim for 200 yards. I can't remember the names of the streets. The street off to your left, and there's a wide steps right up to your right. Yeah, there's a sort of there's an alleyway, wide alleyway with many steps that goes up to your right. If you look just to your right there, and on the left-hand side, you'll see a little neon sign that says Kollel America, Kupat Rabbi Meir Bar Hanes. It's still there, still doing well. So the first thing, by this time, more and more complications. All this is the encroachment of modernity onto the Yishuv. The first Aliyah in the 1880s did not come to Jerusalem. The first Aliyah, the Chovevei Tzion, largely traditional, under the sponsorship of Baron Rothschild, etc., went to agricultural settlements in the north. Virtually none of them came to Jerusalem. The second Aliyah, which was a much more ideological Aliyah and basically Russian maskilim, secular, mainly secular. I don't know what those words mean in that context, but they were certainly not as observant as the existing inhabitants of Palestine. They were modern. Started coming to Jerusalem in the first decade of the 20th century, and at the same time, the Zionist movement itself began to be split over the same issues. Why was Mizrahi founded? Right? Do I have to ask this in Netivot? Why was Mizrahi founded? Why did Mizrahi walk out of the 4th and 5th Zionist Congresses? It wasn't Judaism, it was education. Education. It was over the gymnasium in Jaffa, right? Over the issue of education. Right, over the issue of education. Mizrahi was founded over the issue of education. And then there was a compromise and they went back in. But in 1905. But in 1912, Mizrahi walked out of the 10th Zionist Congress and went back in. But a group of leaders, mainly from Germany, decided that they could not compromise on the issue of education in the new settlements and in the Zionist movement. And they formed Agudas Yisrael in 1912 in Katowice. Yeah? It is interesting to note that the people who formed Aguda were originally the Mizrahi delegates to the Zionist Congress who came from Germany, where they had the tradition of Hirsch and the Austritzgemeinde, right? From Hungary, where they had the tradition of the Chasam Sofer, and from Switzerland, who were also the Hirschians, right? Very much Hirschians. So these were the people who had a strong separatist tradition in their kehillahs, and they founded Aguda. But The Aguda was originally founded as a counterweight to Mizrahi and as part of the Zionist organization. By 1910, a number of things were clear. 1910, 1912, certainly by the time the Aguda was founded. And that was that, and this is again crucial to our story, and I'm sorry that this is a long and complicated story, but if you want to know the facts as opposed to what was printed in the, you know, whatever last week, these are the facts. And like I said, this was fixed a long time before Tehran. By the end of the first decade of the 20th century, it was clear to Orthodoxy in Europe, it was clear to the Orthodox Yeshuv in Jerusalem and elsewhere, that they could not retain leadership in any part of the Jewish world, including in Palestine. That just by force of numbers, by force of influence, they could not single-handedly hold back the tide of modernity, the tide of change, whether it was good, whether it was bad, irrelevant. They could not any longer successfully struggle to retain leadership over any part of the Jewish world except their own part, right? Except those people who said, voluntarily, I want to be part of you. The educational battle had been lost, both in the diaspora and in Palestine, certainly by that time. The second Aliyah was beginning to stream into Israel. In Palestine, there were new colonies springing up all over the place, over which the old Yishuv had no control whatsoever. And then I mentioned before the question of culture, right? The question of culture. There was a period, let me go back one stage, there was a period when the old Yeshuv tried very hard to relate to the new settlements. And the symbol of this was the famous 1914 tour of the new Moshavim, the new Moshavot, whatever you want to ask in feminine. It was a sort of a revivalist tour organized by Ben Tzion Yadler. Ben Tzion Yadler was known as the Maggid of Yerushalayim. Anyone who reads Agnon, right? Anyone here read Agnon? Agnon's book, T'mol Shulshom, he appears as Reb Yankel Grunem Pupik. Yeah? He's a picture of Ben Tzion Yadler. Ben Tzion Yadler wrote wonderful memoirs, which I have a copy called B'Tuv Yerushalayim. And he was a maggid. He was a wonderful orator. He could cry, he could laugh, he could, you know. And he used to be on every occasion the Yerushalayim, the Jerusalem maggid. And he organized, he was very concerned with Shemitah and agricultural mitzvahs, and he organized a tour of the Galil in a cart. And in the cart were, interestingly, Ben Tzion Yadler, Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was Rav Diskin's successor, and we'll talk about him in a moment, Rav Cook, yeah? They were all in the cart, and four or five others. We have a diary and an account, in fact, two diaries and accounts of that tour. It's quite interesting, but at that point, they were still wondering, can we do it? I mentioned the cultural battle that they realized was coming over the question of Ivrit, yeah? That they abandoned Ivrit in the early 20th century, in favor of Yiddish. But in 1912, when Aguda was founded in Europe, a Palestinian Aguda was founded in Yerushalayim. And the two heads of the Aguda in Palestine were Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, a legendary figure who was the leader of the non-Zionist and anti-Zionist Yeshuv right up until his death in 1935, and a fascinating character who in my mind is much, much, much underestimated in his general influence, Rav Moshe Bloy. Moshe Bloy was the older brother of Amram Bloy, who was the founder of Mitzvah Karta. Moshe Bloy was the secretary of the Aguda in Palestine from its founding right up until, officially until 1935, but he was a leader until his death, died under very strange circumstances in 1946. And Moshe Bloy also wrote his own memoirs, which are fascinating, fascinating to read. Moshe Bloy was the son of Hungarian settlers, Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer, and they they formed a Palestinian branch of Aguda. There was always a great difference between the Palestinian Aguda and the European Aguda, right? Great, great, great difference. And the Palestinian Aguda saw that as the First World War was coming and the Ottoman Empire was fading, they began to wonder what is going to happen, who is going to be the rulers of Palestine, right, when the Ottoman Empire breaks up. Well, we know what happened. The First World War arrived. The First World War had terrible consequences on the old Yishuv of Jerusalem, mainly because during the First World War, no Chalukah money could reach Jerusalem. And it's estimated that there was real famine and real poverty in Jerusalem in the First World War. It's estimated that much as 15 or 20% of the Jewish population of Jerusalem died of malnutrition during the First World War. But so then after the war, everything was different, because after the war, the British were in charge and the Balfour Declaration had been issued. The old Yishuv found itself in real crisis, and it had no means of sustenance, because the Chalukah money was no longer coming after the First World War, the Russian Revolution. Many areas of Europe were no longer sending money, number one. Number two, its young people had no means of earning a living, because for 30 or 40 years they had not allowed them to have any access to trades or languages or training of any sort. So what happened there was that probably nearly a third of them, probably a quarter of them, died. Quite a number of them, a huge number, probably as many as a third, maybe not quite a third, but another quarter simply left the old Yishuv and joined the Zionist settlements, snipped off their payers, changed their clothes, and went to join the new Yishuv. Many of them emigrated, and if you look around, again, many of you will know that throughout the America, Britain, Australia, South Africa particularly, in the years from the 1920s onwards, there were many, many Clay Kodesh, rabbis, Chazonim, Shochetim, Hebrew teachers, who were children of Jerusalem who had emigrated in the early 1920s. Many, many, many. I once made a list in England alone, identified about 15 or 16, I'm sure there were many more. And in America, there were many, many, many. Some of them famous, some of them not so famous, some of them Yehudi Menuhin's father, infamous, yeah? But many of them, about as many, many, many Yerushalmim emigrated because they could not earn a living, and then many of them stayed, right? Many of them were faithful to the Yishuv. Immediately after the First World War, there were a series of turning points. First of all, the members of the old Yishuv, who organized themselves into something called the Vad Ha'ir Lekilat Ashkenazim, yeah, lobbied the whole time with the British to be recognized as an independent political group within the Yishuv. The British, as a result of the Balfour Declaration, recognized the Zionist movement as the official representative of the Jewish community in Palestine. The Haredim, the old Yishuv in Jerusalem, represented by the Palestinian Aguda, said, "Hey guys, we don't accept that. We were here first. Yeah, we were here before," and they were actually right. We never agreed to this. You're imposing this on us, and we want to be treated as an independent religious group. You have in Palestine the Jews represented by the Jewish Agency, have the Christians, you have in many, many different denominations, you have many minorities. We want to be one of those minorities. Again, this is the Hirschian and Hungarian Auschwitz Gemeinde. The memoirs of Sir Ronald Storrs, the first military governor, you know, that before the mandate, there was military governance of Palestine for about 3 or 4 years, called OITA. Ronald Storrs was the military governor of Palestine. He wrote a very famous memoirs called Orientations, where he talks about this at length. And the truth is that many of the British administrators had some sympathy, particularly over matters of Shechita, over matters of Matzah, etc. But it could not last. And from this point on, we see a clear route to Natori Carter. Their argument the whole time was, we are not part of the Zionist Yishuv. We were here first, we had our own community organization, we want to be independent. In 1926, when they fixed the elections, the Palestine National Assembly, the Vad Lumi, they were not granted the right to be independent, but they were granted the right to withdraw from the elections, what was called the Chodesh HaYetziyah. About 12,000 people in Jerusalem, registered that they did not want to be part of the Vad Lumi. It was actually a fairly pointless gesture, but they did it nevertheless. Number one on the list was Joseph Klein Sonnenfeld, who went by himself. He went with a big party of people and made a big thing of being the first signatory. But it gets more and more and more and more complicated, because, of course, we are not far off the rise of Nazism. And there were two things that brought the Palestinian and the European a good closer. One of them, the Arab riots of the 1920s, shook the Orthodox Yeshuv very much, because they suddenly realized that they could not have this pretense of we are different from the Zionists, you argue with them and leave us alone. Right? They were not immune, particularly Hebron, etc. They were not immune at all from Arab nationalist antagonism. But number two, much more important, was the rise of Hitler. And with the rise of Hitler, the European Aguda started in the early 1930s already in Poland and in Germany, encouraging and strengthening Aliyah. And there was a rapprochement between the Aguda and the Zionist movement in those years. As this Aliyah went on, the Hungarians in the Yold Yeshuv again became a minority. But under the leadership of Moshe Bloy and Josef Chaim Sonnenfeld, they moderated their anti-Zionism and they encouraged Aliyah. Moshe Bloy, in 1939, those of you who know the intricacies of the diplomacy between the British, the Jews, and the Arabs in the 1930s, know that there was a famous St. James's Roundtable Conference in 1939, I think. 1939, early 1939. Moshe Bloy attended the St. James's Roundtable Conference on behalf of the Aguda. There is a fabulous photo taken in St. James's Palace of all of these diplomats and Arabs and whatnot. In the middle is Reb Moshe Bloy with long silver payas. Yeah, he was a very handsome man. Long silver payas. And in that, the Aguda, both in Palestine and in Europe, issued statements. They fully supported the Balfour Declaration and the establishment of a national home. One group, even with the Palestinian Aguda, opposed all of this, and this was the group headed by Moshe Bloy's younger brother, Amram Bloy, who called themselves, first of all, the Chevras Chaim, right? Named after, I think, Josef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who was only known in his life as Chaim. And they maintained an uncompromising fight against the assumption of authority in Palestine in general, in Jerusalem in particular, by Jewish Agency and the what was then still the Asefat Nivcharim, the Jewish National Council. Yes. The Balfour Declaration, correct. The split, totally split, right? Amram, the famous Amram Blau. The Aguda were signatories. No Agudist wants to admit this anymore, but Aguda were signatories of the Declaration of Independence. Reb Itcher Meir Levin was a signatory of the Megillat HaAtzmaut. Itcher Meir Levin was a major leader of Aguda at the time. No Agudists wants to, and most of them don't know it, right? Most of them don't know it, and none of them want to admit it, but they were signatories to the Declaration of Independence. By the Second World War, with Morocco, right. The By 1939, the circle around Amram Bloy had seceded from the secessionists, right? Had seceded, they were a breakaway group from the breakaway group. But they made it clear that they would not accept any civic or political control, particularly by that time they restricted their demands to Jerusalem at all. In 1945, during the Second World War, everything was, for obvious reasons, quiet. In 1945, straight after the war, there were elections in Jerusalem, and the Natori Carter group won the elections for the Vad Ha'ir LeKilat Ashkenazim, which later became known as the Eda Haredit, right, which is still the sort of internal self-government of Me'er Sha'arim and surrounding districts. They spent the time between 1945 and 1948 vigorously petitioning the United Nations to internationalize Jerusalem and not give Jerusalem in any partition plan, not give Jerusalem in any way to the to any future Jewish government. Yeah? And that is where the beginning of Natori Carter comes from. However, that is only the beginning. And since Tehran, I have to add another 5 minutes, which I hope you're going to forgive me, which is what happened after World War II. What happened after World War II was that Natori Carter and Satmar became, for a long time, indistinguishable. The Satmar Rebbe, most people think Satmar is the old Hasidic dynasty. Satmar was founded in the 1920s. Yeah? It's not an old, ancient Hasidic dynasty at all. The Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yehudah Teitelbaum, as is well known, was rescued from Belsen, actually, by the Zionist organization. He spent the rest of the war in Switzerland. He came after the war, 1946. He spent a year or so in Yerushalayim. There are many. He was actually a very. He had a very sharp sense of humor. And he said that the first time he went down Me'er Sha'arim, he looked around and he said. He said in Yiddish, I said in English. He says, "This looks like a churva. This looks like a ruin." He says, "Only the glue from the posters on the walls are keeping the walls up, preventing the walls from falling down." The other story about him is that he didn't know that in Yerushalayim there's a minhag that you bring in Shabbos 18 minutes earlier than otherwise. He went to the mikveh and was being driven home. And it was already Shabbos, everyone was throwing stones and yelling Shabbos at his car. But, however, two people kept Natori Carter going during the 50s and 60s. One of them was, of course, Amram Bloy. Amram Bloy, who was also I'm saying it in the honorific sense, it's a title, he was a Kanoi. He was a fanatic. And Amram Bloy, sorry? I'll come on to the Satmar connection in a moment, right? Amram Bloy was the acknowledged leader, and he was a fanatic, but he was he had a degree of statesmanship about him, and he made it a very principled thing of not paying taxes, not receiving any money from the state of Israel. If possible, not using their passport, not using his postage stamps. He never left Israel at all because he wouldn't take a passport. And Amram Bloy died, I think, in about 1971. But the Satmar Rebbe, Reb Yoidish Teitelbaum, then became a major on the other side of the Atlantic. He left Jerusalem only stayed there about 12, less than a year and a half. He went to Brooklyn and he established Satmar. And it is from him that, and you'll notice that I haven't mentioned at all anything about the Messiah coming or establishing a state. The whole theme of it is wrong to establish a state before the coming of the Messiah dates from the 1950s. Yeah, yes, it was there before. Yes, it was there before, but it was never a major theme, right? It was never, ever a major theme. Reb Yol Teitelbaum wrote a famous book called Vayol Moshe, which was published in three or four parts between 1953 and 1958. In Vayol Moshe, he argues there are three essays in Vayol Moshe. One is called Maima Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, which is a discussion about the machlokes between the Ramban and the Rambam about whether it is a mitzvah or not to live in Israel. One is Maima Shaloshavos, right? One is the essay on the three vows, which is the central sort of motif, became the central motif of Natori Karta, in which he takes, there's a Nagadata in Kesuvos, which talks about that God makes Israel take three vows. Number one, that they will not go up to the land of Israel en bloc, whatever that means, that they will not revolt against the nations, and they will not try and force the coming of the Messiah. And he argued, the Samar Rebbe argued in this book by Yol Moshe, that the establishment of the State of Israel was a violation of each of these three things, each of these three provisions. Of course, the riposte to that is the next sentence of the Gemara, which says that all of this is on condition that the other nations of the world treat the Jewish people fairly. And if they don't treat the Jewish people fairly, then Israel is not bound by those three vows. Well, no one in 1945 could argue that the nations of the world were treating the Jewish people fairly, right? It is impossible to argue that. No more about history, but the history of the past 1,000 years, history of the previous 5 years, no one could argue that, number one. Number two, Israel was established by vote of the United Nations. So it's very difficult to argue that was a revolt against the nations. Yeah, it was, Well, okay, sorry. I was talking about nobody. I can't. Okay, thank you for the correction. Your point is well taken. It is difficult to argue that, right? Let me replace that phrase. It is difficult to argue that, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But nevertheless, Satmar became the chief financial and moral and whatever supporters of Natori Karta during those years. My friend Jerry Fried, when I said, oh, it was never a thing, goes, it was way back. Right. You have to be very careful here because this whole field is strewn with forgeries, right? And the biggest forgery of all is a two-volume book called Dovev Sifsei Yeshenim, right? Dovev Sifsei Yeshenim is an anthology of anti-Zionist proclamations by 19th century rebbes, yeah? Going all the way back, yeah? The only problem is the whole book from beginning to end is written by a Satmar Chosid called Moshe Ephraim Bloch in Brooklyn in the 1950s. He wrote every single word of it. It's a forgery from beginning to end. And the person who first told me it was a forgery way back in 1974 was none other than the Rev. Joachim Schlesinger. Anyone who knows Natori Karta will know the name of Rev. Joachim Schlesinger. He lived till 120. He's about 110 as it is. He was for many years the president of Natori Karta in England, and he still is. And he is married to the daughter of Rav Moshe Bloy, his wife, who was a wonderful woman in her own right. And he told me when I interviewed him for my dissertation, my thesis, I went to see him in Stamford Hill, and he couldn't speak English. He'd been in England for 30 years at that time. He couldn't speak a word of English. His son was translating, and I noticed, because I'd been studying all this stuff. Here I was, a young man sitting in the Bodleian Library reading all this sort of Haredi, Natori Karta stuff. And I noticed that on his bookshelf, he had a wonderful bookshelf, as you would imagine, but the book Dovev Sifsei Yeshenim, the two volumes, which I recognized from its binding because I'd been looking at it, was sitting not in the bookshelf, it was on top of the bookshelf. I said, this is Alles geschwindelt. Right? So he himself, even in Satmar, even in Natori Karta, everyone knows. If you want to look at it academically, there's a book by a guy called Weingarten called Mismachim Mezuyafim Neged HaTzionut, which analyzes the whole book from beginning to end. So it's very, but you see, this was published.
Where the what comes
from? This was published, this book was translated, extracts of this book were translated by a Satmar in London, a Natori Kartanik called Yerachmiel Dom. Yerachmiel Dom was a Natori Kartanik who made his living from manufacturing crucifixes. He was a jeweler, right? He was a wholesaler of crucifixes. And he translated this into an English book called The Disputation. And this book has found its way into all sorts of academic things. And all sorts of historians, Jewish, non-Jewish, rely on this little translation. But the truth is that all of these documents, you have to be very, very, very careful. All of these documents are forged. Yeah, all of them are forged. Yeah.
Mikvah Lozer. So
1930s. Yeah.
Well,
yes.
And I don't think those two are forgery.
Those two are not forgery. Those two, there were. I'm not saying there weren't. Jerry, I'm not saying there wasn't opposition, particularly at the time of the, but at the time of the first Congress, right? There was a lot of splits in the rabbinic world whether Zionism was a good thing or a bad thing. Well, I have right. I have a lot of.
I
have a lot of reservations. He should have a refush lema, but I have a lot of reservations about that book. So, after the Second World War, Natori Carta was an alliance between a tiny group in Jerusalem, but a much larger and more louder group in Brooklyn. As long as the two figures of Reb Yoel Teitelbaum and Reb Amram Bloy were alive, right? It was there and it was vigorous, but it was under control. When, first of all, when Amram Bloy died in, I think it was about 1971, his Natori Carta split into totally uncontrolled groups. And it split into, really, you want to go right into the thing, it split into the Hirsch faction and the Kaschner-Ellenbogen faction, right? It doesn't matter who what. But it began to be totally uncontrolled, and the more photogenic and publicity-hunting Natori Carta, which Amram Bloy wasn't, right, suddenly hit the headlines. And you had then Natori Carta in Israel, headed by a guy called Moshe Hirsch, who many of you, the American, the foreign minister, right, who is still around, who was the minister in Arafat's government. And you also had an increasingly vocal Natori Carta overseas. You then had this bizarre process whereby they reinvented tradition, right? They reinvented tradition, and the whole argument became very much centered on was it right, can we return to Israel before the Messiah came, right? Before the Messiah came, which, as I said, was absolutely not. And it, you know, it even plain logic, right? The fact that the Chasam Sofer encouraged his pupils to go and settle Eretz Israel, the fact that Moshe Yehoshua Leib Diskin and Sonnenfeld and everyone else went to live in Israel shows that they had no compunctions about going to live in Israel, right? About going to live in Israel. And the fact they tried under the British to establish their own little legislative enclave also shows they didn't have many compunctions, when necessary, about setting up a sort of government in Israel either. But since the 1950s, certainly since the Six-Day War, the whole argument has become about the Messiah and can you set up a state before the Messiah, etc., 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 which historically is not true. Historically, it doesn't make any difference, unfortunately. I'm a historian, right? But I want to put that marker down, but it doesn't, because whatever the argument is today, that's what the argument is, that's what it's become, right? That's what it's become. Realistically, that's what it's become. So you have what I tried to do, again, skipping over most of what I wanted to say, what I've tried to do is to show you that these guys who turned up in Tehran are the result of a long historical chain of events that begins in the fight against emancipation and against non-rabbinic community leadership in Hungary and elsewhere, Hungary and then Germany in the 19th century, continued through the fight to preserve Jerusalem in particular as a pre-modern enclave protected from the all of the illnesses of emancipation in the open society, carried on right through the Mandate period, right through the Mandate period on the one hand, the arguments with the British authorities for autonomy, and on the other hand, the fight not to be absorbed in the authority of the Zionist organization, the Zionist Yishuv. And then, after the establishment of the state, carries on as a sort of a rearguard action against what has been done. I indicated last week, and I indicated at the beginning, that this is a very, 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 very express Torah through an exceptionally complicated historical parasha that changes every time. I have to say, and I'm just going to finish with this, I have to say that I have a certain sympathy with the pre-1948 Yishuv, the old Yishuv pre-1948. Because it is true, their case is actually correct, that they were there first and they did not, they were against, almost by force of circumstances, I'm not going to say against their will, but by force of circumstances, events overtook them. And they, Sephardim were there even before, but the Sephardim had sort of, did not have political ambition and did not have ideological, Sephardim disappeared as the old sort of Sephardi elite of Yerushalayim sort of just went into the new Yishuv. They went into the new Yishuv. The Rivlins and the and all of those families. But I have a certain sympathy with them, but like many other groups in history, unfortunately events took them over. What they've done since the Second World War is a whole different parasha. And what they've done since the deaths of Reb Yoilish on the one hand and Amram Bloy on the other is also much more out of control. When Reb Yoilish Teitelbaum died in 1979, his successor, who was his nephew, who was already in his 60s when he took it up, was much less interested in Zionism, Israel, anti-Zionism. And the temperature in Satmar, the anti-Zionist temperature in Satmar, drastically declined under the last Satmar Rebbe. He really was just not interested in that stuff. What will happen now with the two new, what is it, Aaron and Yoel? Zalman and Aaron, right? Zalman and Aaron, I have no idea. But that's the story. Yeah. Sorry. I think it's a young lady. Maybe it was first. Because, as I said, one of the they treat the title Kanoi, fanatic, as an honorific, and they believe very strongly that the only legitimate Jewish society is one ruled by rabbinic authority, and they will, and that any other group that usurps authority, right, is bringing Satanism into the world. I can't answer for them, right? I can only tell you the history. I can't answer for them. But I don't know whether this is true or not, right? But my experience with talking, and over the years I've talked to many, many Tory Carsonics and Summers, is that they live in a very off-kilter world, right? If you don't watch television and you don't read newspapers and you don't have a general education and you don't know what's going on in the world, you can see the world through very strange prisms. And I think that's what I think they have a very restricted, they are very politically savvy people, but they make their judgments on very skewed data. You have to ask them that, not me. You have to ask them, not me. Yeah.
But how does that take them?
Because they've come to believe that the state of Israel is the antithesis of everything Jewish in the world. Worse than that, it's successful. Right? Worse than that, it's successful.
Delaying the Messiah. But it's delaying the Messiah.
You have to ask them that. I don't know. You can argue with it. Many people argue with it. You know, at the end of the Second World War, right, two important books were published. Right, one of them, a few years later, was Yoel Teitelbaum's book, Vayol Moshe, right? In which he blamed everything on the Zionist revival, the misuse of the Hebrew language, etc., etc. So interestingly, the one on the use of Hebrew, on whether it's permitted to use modern Hebrew, was addressed to Pinchas Hirschsprung in Montreal, who wrote him a shaila saying, is it permitted to teach a Brit in Beis Yaakov in Montreal? But the other book was by Reb Shlomo Teichthal called Eim HaBenim Semecha. They both came from the same part of the world. They both went through the same horrors of the war. Reb Shlomo Teichthal wrote in Eim HaBenim Semecha that the reason that the war came, right, was because the Jewish world had not joined wholeheartedly in the Zionist enterprise. So, you know, they're both from the same place, both from the same area, both of them equally from the heartlands of Hungarian Orthodoxy, and both reaching diametrically opposite conclusions. The reaction, by the way, to the guys who went to Tehran, even from Satmar, right? Even from Satmar, the Satmar based in, yeah, both in Israel, and the Eda Haredus in Israel, yeah, has published statements putting these guys in Cherem so far as it's possible to do that, but clearly disassociating themselves from their actions. I'm not a halachist, but there are 120 halachic reasons why what they did was inexcusable. Yeah. Yes, he did. That's why I said that as long as Yoel Teitelbaum and Amram Bloy were alive, right, there was a statesman-like, not everyone will agree with everything, particularly that either of them did, right, at different times, but both of them had a statesman-like sense, and between them, they kept the world under control, right? Once they died, both in Satmar and in Torikarta, it was total fragmentation, and Torikarta is not an organization. There's no formal organization. Anyone can stand up on a street corner and say, I represent Natori Karta, right? There's no, what's his name? Yeah.
Did you agree that the basic problem is that they lost the power struggle, and therefore they made up all of these things that they can't
You could definitely argue that, yes. Yeah, you could definitely argue that. But it's so complicated because, for example, the question of the Second World War, right? Yoel Teitelbaum, his life was saved by Zionist organization, no question of it. He got on the famous train, he got out of Belsen. So it's like, I once compared it to a guy who's trapped on the roof of a burning house, right? And the local fire service come, right? And they rescue him, yeah? They save his life. He has no other way of getting down. He's on the roof of a burning building. They come and they save his life. And when he gets down on dry land, he starts a campaign to ban fire services. Right? Yeah, Joey. First of all, the circle of influence of this is the Rashab, right? Who wrote the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe was deeply anti-Zionist. Yeah, so was the sixth, and so was the seventh. But he at least published on it, right? But his influence was tiny. Who was Chabad in 1910? He had no influence.
Luber's ideas, peace now, took them up in the 80s. Rav Chaim Volozhin's idea of yeshiva was tiny in his time. All ideas started somewhere. It may not have had influence in his time, but it was adopted and kept growing.
Come out of nowhere. Agreed. Right. But you see, the Minchas Elazar was not totally. He was opposed to many things. He was opposed to everything. He was opposed to America. He was opposed to modernity, and he was opposed to the Zionist movement. Right. He was opposed most of all to the Aguda, right? That was his, who he saw as collaborators, etc. Yeah, of course they were there, but they were not the major sort of wall-to-wall Zionist opposition to Zionism that nowadays those who hold that view would like to make out. The Gera Rebbe in the 1930s circulated, and I was once shown one, circulated hundreds of thousands, I don't know, of printed appeals to his Hasidim in Poland to go to Israel, to go to Palestine. Yeah, the Poale Agudas Israel, right, and the Aguda all had settlements and all had rabbis who were in favor. So it's not, yes, that I'm not saying there wasn't a, you know, there were many other anti-Zionists, there were secular anti-Zionists as well. But it was not the wall-to-wall opposition that you often read that all Orthodox rabbis oppose Zionism. That is absolutely not true. And including from the yeshiva world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very, very difficult territory because there are, and incidentally, Chabad also have many forgeries in their history. Yeah, in the 1920s, there's a famous parasha of the forging of Chabad documents. But in anti-Zionism, there are many, many, many forged, totally forged, made-up documents. And there was a factory in Brooklyn in the 1950s. Moshe Ephraim Bloch, yeah, was the guy who was churning out these things.
Lemuel Park.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. One last question. Yes?
Well,
yeah.
I think your little metaphor was interesting,
yeah,
about the fellow one. And I think that's the struggle that I'm having, or anybody else, is why anybody, I mean, take your metaphor, what's the underpinning of somebody who's just been saved by the fire department to then argue
You have to go back. In this case, you have to go back to last Sunday morning, right, at 9:30, put the two sessions together, and understand that all of this, what all of this is about, is the dilemma of rabbinic authority in Judaism in the open society. Yeah? How do we manage? How do we deal with emancipation? How do we deal with the open society? What is the place of orthodoxy? What is the place of authority in Jewish organizations? What is the place of culture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And that is what this is about from beginning to end. Thank you very much. This has been a very enjoyable 2 weeks.